Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining me today to answer your gardening questions is a program regular. Fred Breglia is director of the Landis Arboretum in Esperance, New York. And this, I believe our producer Patrick Donja said this is our third one of the year.
I believe that's correct.
How time flies. We welcome your calls right now at 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. Or you can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Or you can tweet your questions to Fred or your comments at WAMC Vox Pop. So there you go. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551. Get in line early. So, Fred, how's it going over at the Landis Arboretum?
Things are going really good. In fact, we're getting ready to kick off our summer music series officially tomorrow night at our newly renovated meeting house. And that's going to kick off at 7 o'clock tomorrow night with the first act being Molly Dernan and the John Scarpula Band.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll go from 7 to 10. And right now it's a suggested donation of $10 entry fee. And we have a brand new renovated meeting house, phenomenal acoustics, $1 million view, brand new
Beautiful.
Deck. The deck will probably hold 50, 60, 70 people easily just on the deck alone.
Oh, really
so
nice.
Now, really excited.
The bad weather that rolled through yesterday, any big effects at the Arboretum?
I noticed a few branches down. Most of it was dead wood, though, so it kind of actually kind of helped me out a little bit.
Cleared it out.
And we got a driveway that's borderline washed out a little bit.
But, okay.
Can't complain about that.
Not at all. Let's go to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. It's Gene in Duanesburg. Gene, you're on.
Gene.
Hello, is it Gene?
No, it's Ardine.
Oh, Ardine, you're on.
Yes. Thank you. Last year, I had mold or a problem with my cucumbers and my zucchini, that dusty mold thing.
Oh, powdery. Maybe powdery mildew, probably like a white.
That's it.
Yep.
And I kept cutting the leaves off as it died. And then the mold kept getting on the brand new one. Was that me? Was it something I was doing wrong? Or
well,
was it the weather?
Well, the weather is probably the main factor. In fact, a lot of times it's a mildew that actually tends to be sometimes worse on years when it's drier, which is not usually the case with most of our friends, the molds, or our enemies, the molds, depending
buddies.
On our situation here. But with powdery mildew, sometimes when rain actually helps to wash those spores off the leaves of the plants, and it's a natural control. So if it can get a hold and there hasn't been any kind of hard rains, a lot of times those spores will take effect and you'll get powdery mildew pretty extensively. Now, cultural conditions such as any time that you're taking, moldy leaves off, always want to make sure you sterilize those pruners. And I use like rubbing alcohol in a little spray bottle, and I'll spray the blades on the pruners or the scissors that you're using, because if you do go from one leaf to another, you could spread those spores around. So by pruning diseased material of any sort, general rule is to, literally sterilize those tools between cuts.
Mm.
But, that being said, I would not compost those spored up leaves. Another good control, too, is sometimes get the garden hose out if it is going to be really dry. And in the morning, it's better to do this in the morning so that the leaves have time to dry over the course of the day and you're not putting them to bed wet. But you get the spray nozzle on your hose and literally forcefully kind of spray the leaves off. And it's a good preventative because it simulates heavy rains. So if we're not getting heavy rains, which certainly has not been the case lately, at least not in our neck of the woods, but that's another method of control.
Okay. And how was
Thank you.
By the way, how was the storm out in Duanesburg yesterday?
The wind blew like mad here, and I live in the woods, so my heart was pounding.
Yes, I bet
100
it was.
Miles an hour. But the wind just blew, and a few I was listening to you earlier. Dead branches fell off the trees. I was glad I moved my truck from under the...
Fair enough.
Because this gigantic branch came down, probably would have gone right through my truck.
Wow. That would have been bad news if you liked the truck. If it was an old truck, you know, it's might have been a good thing, right?
No, I love my truck.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling. I'm glad you survived. I appreciate the call. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Susan in Saugerties, you're on.
Oh, yeah. Hi.
Hi.
I live in a fairly shady site, you know, Saugerties tends to be kind of soggy. They call it soggy trees sometimes. And I have a Burkwoodii viburnum at the corner of my house.
I like the
love
plant.
It.
Me too.
Love it.
Yep, great viburnum.
Last spring, about 75% of the leaves on it came out all crumpled up, all twisted. They were green. They weren't discolored, but they were all twisted.
Yep, that doesn't sound, it sounds like, what happened later in the season?
One of the branches, one whole branch of the bush died. And now this spring, again, the same thing, of the remaining branches, about 75% of them, 60 or 75%, except for the top growth. But the thing of it is, it grows in front of my kitchen window, so I've been pruning the top growth off, hoping to make a shorter, you know, stouter shrub, but it never works. It just keeps getting leggier and leggier, and I keep pruning it back. So I'm wondering, you know, I don't know what, you know.
Do the leaves look normal this year, though?
No, most of them are crumpled the way they were last year.
Crumpled, okay.
Except for the ones right at the very top of the leggy top growth.
And they look normal.
Some of them look normal. Have you seen
any insects on it, or have you looked close?
I have not. I have looked very, very carefully, and I have not seen insects.
Okay.
And I looked online, for diseases and pests for this kind of viburnum, and I found nothing that was pertinent to this problem.
All right, because a lot of times when you see crumpled up leaves, a lot of cases are caused by an insect that has a piercing, sucking mouth part.
Uh-huh.
And the way it works is they'll, you know, literally stick their little piercing, sucking mouth part in a leaf, and then it'll suck the juice out of it. And when it sucks the juice out of it, it's kind of like if you ever use one of those little, like, Capri Suns or one of those juice packets.
Yeah,
it deflates.
Sure.
It deflates, exactly.
Sure,
and
it's
so
clear.
It's a similar kind of effect. So
I didn't do it this year, but last year I took, and I must have taken it, 20 leaves and uncrumpled them very, very carefully to see if there was anything inside of them. And I have to say, I didn't identify anything.
All right. Well, then the other thing that I've seen happen with them is that sometimes early spring feeding, very early spring feeding occurs. They'll suck the juice out of the plant. And then they'll move away and they'll go elsewhere. But then the leaf will continue to grow. But once it's in that distorted state, yes. And so that's my guess, is that it's probably an insect, maybe aphid related, with a piercing, sucking mouth part that probably fed early on.
But why did a whole branch of this bush die?
All right. The other thing
died right back.
Okay. Well, you know, that tells me that there may be either something else going on with it. Is it in a wet area?
Not particularly, no.
Okay. It's getting shade, or is it getting too much shade? Or
no, it gets a fair amount of sun. I have it in in about the sunniest place I could put it.
And the death occurs from the bottom up or top of the plant? Or is it more sporadic?
It was just the whole branch.
The whole branch.
I noticed it last fall that this branch had died, and, you know, and there it sits. I haven't pruned it out yet. It's
Do you ever notice any ants on it?
No.
No ants. Okay.
Mm. I think you've stumped the panel.
Well,
panel is one, so you've done it.
You might also look at the branches close and see if there's, do you know what scale insect is?
I sure do.
Yeah, just check the branches to see that. It's not something that's usually common on a viburnum Burkwoodii.
No. I think I would see that. Because what I actually did, I must be crazy, last spring, I went and I pruned off, nipped off all of the affected leaves. Because I thought, oh my gosh, if it's an insect, maybe I can, you know, and I threw them away in the garbage. I didn't put them in the compost or the mulch or anything, you know. And so I think at that point, I was inspecting and handling the bush so much that if there was scale,
you would have noticed it. All right. Well, you know, if you want to send me some pictures of it, I might be able to diagnose it a tad bit further. And you can send those to my email, which is fred@landisarboretum.org. So,
all right. Susan, we got to take a break here, but thank you so much for calling. And, you know, Greg Ward of Ward's Nursery couldn't make it today. It's a solo show. It's Fred Breglia of Landis Arboretum. We welcome your calls, 1-800-348-2551. More gardening coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, featuring an assortment of plants, flowers, and landscaping tools and products Monday through Sunday, 8 to 5. A gardener's destination, storiesnursery.com. Woodstock School of Art, offering classes and workshops in drawing, painting, printmaking, sculpture, and more for all levels. Tuition assistance available, woodstockschoolofart.org. Veterinary Emergency and Specialty Hospital, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, providing 24-hour emergency and critical care for dogs and cats every day, including all holidays, veshdeerfield.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole-grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. And Boyden & Perron, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services and a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years, boydenandperron.com.
Fun Drive starts Monday morning at 6 a.m. Be with us wherever you find us on the radio dial or online at WAMC.org. We will be with you starting at 6 a.m. Monday. You can make a pledge now at our website, WAMC.org. You can feed the lockbox, and everything we raise between now and the beginning of the drive counts on day one. As of this morning, it was, I think, $121,000. Yeah, and so good. I mean, you know, that's probably one day off the drive. If you want to shorten it further, get those pledges on now online. Patrick Donges, our producer, joins us, and he's got something from one of our social media organs.
Yes. Hi, Ray. Hi, Fred.
Hello.
We have a comment posted at WAMC.org on our Vox Pop page, which you can access at WAMC.org/VOXPOP. Chris in Albany asks, can you tell me about the benefits of no-till gardening, and does it make sense for a small backyard garden? How do I start a no-till garden?
What is it?
Well, you know, that's a good question, and that actually is a really hot topic right now in the horticultural field because, you know, for years, everyone's always been tilling up these gardens. And I'm not saying that it's bad by any means. I'm just saying that's just the method that's been happening. My dad and I have been, you know, we did that for, you know, he did it for as long as I known him. And I, you know, grew up tilling our gardens.
Right.
And it's been a trend more recently where this no-till method of gardening is sort of creeping up to the forefront of a lot of the vegetable gardening arenas. And what it basically is there's a lot of science and a lot of research that's being done with the soil conductivity. When I say soil conductivity, I basically mean that soil, well, first off, it's a living organism, and it contains tons of bacteria and fungi. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, it also has an extensive and very complex capillary system of both for water transport down into the root zone of the plants, and also air exchange, both above and below ground. So the roots are pulling in air, and they're also putting air back into the soil, and that air has to diffuse back out into the atmosphere. So and that's something that's been in place. No one's invented that. That's been here forever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of going back to, okay, well, this is a soil science and complexity that's all been in place for years. How does that get affected by tilling? And one of the things that happens when you till is that a rototiller comes through, and in fact, the more you till it, the more this even happens. It breaks up all of that natural fungi. It also destroys all of the tubular capillaries for air and water exchange between the air and the plants and the roots. So the thinking is that if you can smother the grass with something that would, or the weeds that in your garden area when you're establishing it, you kill that off, all that just stays in place and actually becomes organic food for the plants. you leave all that soil structure completely in place. Mm-hmm. And then when you dig a plant and you plant, you know, if you're going to do seeds, you just make, it's just a soil. It looks like soil just like you would when you till it, only it's just a bare soil.
Yeah.
So you can make a row and you can put the little seeds in, or you can, you know, dig a little hole with a trowel and pop in a tomato plant or a pepper plant. So that's not considered tilling when you dig a little hole.
So are you in favor of this?
I actually am. My wife and I, the last 5 years now, have switched over to no-till method of gardening. When we first learned about it, you know, we were skeptical a little bit, but being an arborist and a horticulturist and understanding plant physiology and how soils work, it made sense. And what we have experienced is A, less backaches because we're not tilling now.
Right. Mm.
B, increased plant growth. So less out of more produce out of less work. And when you, one of the tests for, because there is a lot of still skepticism in the field. One of the things that I would tell people to test, to sort of, which I did myself, is you till an area up and then you plant a couple of tomato plants or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you don't till another area and plant this couple of those tomato plants. And then just right off the start, get when the soil is nice and dry, get a cup of water, couple of cups of water, bottle of water, pour it on the soil surface around the plant root zone, and watch what happens to that soil, to that water.
Yeah.
The one that's been tilled, the water will not soak in instantly. It'll run away from the plant and not soak in. And then after you get it wet enough, of course, then
it starts
to go in. But the one that hasn't been tilled, instant drops right in, goes right through that plumbing system right to the root
zone. All
right,
so then why is there skepticism?
Well, because tilling works. Tilling still produces. People that till gardens and incorporate a lot of compost, it's a method of getting compost material, organics, into the soil profile, and incorporating that organic material into the soil profile is a good thing, and they grow really good plants.
So, okay.
So if it's not broke, don't fix it method. I've been doing this for 20 years. It works really well. Why would we change it? Well, you know, maybe you shouldn't. But I will say with the no-till method, you know, one of the big questions is, how do I get organic matter in the soil? If I can't till it, how do I turn it in? Well, you top dress every year, top dress it. Mm. And a lot of people don't realize that by spreading a couple of inches of organic top.
This is after the planting season is done? Then
you can do it in the spring after you know, what we do is we just cover our patch over for about a month, pop it off, top dress the whole thing. We're always adding organics, but it's always to the top of the soil. People don't realize a lot of times that organic matter actually gets way deep into the soil. It's complete vertical action just by top dressing.
Fair enough.
Wow. So, great.
Yep. Try it. I am swaying more towards the no-till methods. I think it's a great question. It's a hot topic.
Great. Thanks, Fred.
Thank you, Patrick Donges. We appreciate that. And you can always check in at Facebook or Twitter, or our email is voxpop@wamc.org. Let's go to V, just V, in Western Mass. You're on.
Oh, it's Lee, not V.
Oh, it's Lee.
Yeah, it's Lee, and I live in Montague, Massachusetts.
I think our screening person might have a hearing problem, but that's okay.
That's okay. No problem. Oh, good. Okay. So I have a Japanese maple in front of my house, and it was a beautiful mature tree. It's at least 30 years old and maybe older. And after the big storms, we had a big snowstorm at Halloween a couple of years ago. It was hanging on the power lines,
yep.
And I had it pruned back. And last summer, it's still, you know, after the pruning, it came back, beautiful as always. This summer, half of the tree is dead. It appears to be dead. Half of the tree is beautiful, and half of the tree is bare branches. And in a few instances, it looks like the bark is splitting and rolling off. And so I just don't know whether this tree is dying and we should take it down, or, you know, we can't cut off the dead branches. We'll just have half a tree, and it'll look terrible.
Right.
And it does appear that the branches that are dead are the ones that were, you can see where the prune marks are lower down. So it looks like maybe the pruning had some effect.
Well, that's very possible. You know, without seeing it for sure and knowing all the history, it's hard to say that is the absolute cause. But what I will say is that over the years, pruning in general is probably one of the easiest ways. It's one of the most routine maintenance practices done on plants. One of the easiest ways to increase plant productivity and plant health by doing proper pruning cuts at the right time of year. And the B side of that is that, unfortunately, it's also one of the easiest ways to mess up a plant by improperly pruning or pruning even good cuts at the wrong time of year. So that is a factor. Now, the fact that you say it was doing really good and then after the pruning it seemed to be a problem, you know, maybe that is some evidence pointing towards the fact that pruning is maybe the culprit. And one of the things that could happen, there's a lot of factors, is that I don't know if – do you know what topping cuts are, where they just come in and kind of hack off the ends of branches?
That's not what was done.
Okay, that's great.
That's
news.
Bad?
No, topping cuts are not good. That's
okay.
Bad, yeah. So you want to avoid that always. There's no – I can't think of any good reasons to do that. So that we can rule out. The next thing is, okay, so let's just assume that all the pruning cuts were good. Taking too much foliage off all at once is another problem. So, for example, if they took off, you know, half of the tree's foliage from the pruning session, that's going to stress it out. Now, even if they didn't do that, another thing, especially with sensitive bark trees, and Japanese maple is certainly a... I would say a sort of sensitive plant. If you take too much shaded foliage off and you expose the bark that was always the trunk and the bark that was always under a shady condition for years to full sun, it will actually develop, ironically, sort of a sunburn type of condition. And the main time that occurs is usually in the winter months. When you'll notice even more detrimental effects of it. But it happened in the summer, literally taking a tree branch off that was shading an area, open it up full sun, that can cause cambium decline. And you will notice sometimes bark fluffing off, you know, peeling off. The fact that you're seeing that tells me that that part of the branch, you know, definitely is under a pretty substantial state of decline. If it's dead, it's dead, you could technically prune that off because... You know, it's not if it's there's no branches on it, it's not coming back. But you, like you said, it is a sort of like a lopsided tree. Then maybe a new branch could be trained back to fill that gap over the next, you know, 3 to 5 years. I've seen some trees that looked really bad, and I've worked on them at the Arboretum and elsewhere, and have got them back to some pretty nice looking specimens. You just got to sometimes have patience. But it's a shame to hear that is the, you know, the case. The other thing to look for would be to look down at the trunk, and I tend to think this is not the case since it happened so fast, but if you looked at the trunk and you should see a really nice root flare. The place where the trunk and roots meet, that should be a nice area where the trunk comes down and then flares out right at ground level. You don't want to see that trunk going straight into the ground, and you also don't want to have mulch piled up around that trunk. That root flare zone is designed to be at ground level and definitely free from moisture or material that would keep moisture on it.
Okay.
Interesting. I have it underplanted with a whole lot of hostas because it's in a shady spot.
I would say look at the root flare, inspect it, make sure that you see it, and maybe just pull some of the hostas back around it. That might be a problem. You could have some, you know, possible trunk decline right at that root flare zone. Maybe a combination of things, most likely. Maybe the pruning with the root flare. But it sounds like if the only branches that are hurting are the ones that were pruned, maybe indicative that maybe something went wrong with the pruning job.
All right.
I don't care so much about blame. I guess I'm just trying to decide whether to take it down or not because it looks pretty bad
now. So half the tree is looking good?
I'd say a third of the tree is looking good.
Yeah. If the root flare, the trunk area of the where we call the root flare, if that all looks healthy and the branch that's on the third looks solid, it looks like it's all normal, healthy leaves. It's not an insect. It's not a disease. It's definitely cultural. Definitely environmental cultural. My guess is that third of the tree would stabilize, and you might very well have no problems.
So have faith and keep working on it.
Patience.
So give it another season and check out that root flare area and. Well, that's hopeful. That's better. I'd rather not take it down. It's a beautiful tree.
Just curious, when was it pruned? What was the month?
You know, I wish I knew. Yeah. I would have to go. Maybe I'll go back through records, and I'm not sure.
All right. Well, if you find out and you want to, you know, try to diagnose it further, you can email me the date, and that would tell me more information. But,
okay. And your email again, Fred?
It's fred@landisarboretum.org. And like I said, if you have a solid third of that tree, you could retrain new branches to fill a role. Give it 5 years, and you might have a really nice-looking tree again.
All right, Lee, thanks a lot for the call. We go to Jody in Lake Hill, New York. Jody, you're on.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
Good. Welcome aboard.
Well, thank you. I have two questions. One is very short. When is the best time to transplant about a 30-year-old tree peony?
Well, you typically do peonies in the fall. And now a tree peony is different than regular peonies because a tree peony, you don't really divide it out the same way that you would do a normal, you know, herbaceous peony that's grown in your garden. So this is the one you're talking about, the one that never, it has woody stems and it never dies back to the ground.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So that guy is, you know, literally on its own root system, and we need to carefully move that guy. Now, the times that I've moved them, especially when they've been there that long, the best luck I've had is that any time of year, including right now when it's been moist out, if it's been moist in your area, certainly our area, you go out and you get a spade and, a good spade. Go around sort of like you want to sort of outline the root ball that you're going to dig,
mm-hmm.
but you're not going to dig it yet. You're going to just go around the entire plant with the spade.
Give it a warning.
Sort of a warning, but you're doing actually a little bit more than just giving it a warning. What you're doing is you're severing and cutting all of those fibrous roots that would normally be stretched out to three times the width of the canopy spread on that. So the little hair-like roots that are feeding it are going way out all over your yard.
Mm-hmm.
2 to 3 times the canopy spread. So you're going to obviously not dig a root ball that big. So you're going to come in and just use the spade, go straight in. Don't try to pry the plant out of the ground at all. Just literally straight in and then pull the spade straight back out. Go to the next little spot. Same thing all the way around the entire root, the entire tree or shrub. And literally like you were going to dig it, but you left it in the ground. And what that does, in addition to giving it a warning, is it actually forces a whole bunch of new roots to concentrate their growth closer to the stem. And therefore, what you're doing is you're sort of root pruning it now. And you could do this a couple of times throughout the season, no problem. And then when you do finally make that move, the majority of the feeder roots are going to be closer to the stem and way better survival rates and way less, you know, transplant shock. But I would still move that sucker when it's in the fall and when dormant, when it's sleeping.
Okay.
Okay, after it loses its leaves.
Yeah, the leaves drop. You've root pruned it over the, you know, from now, you know, maybe once every month or once every couple of months. And then in the fall, we move it after it's sleeping. The goal would be to, you know, water it in well, let it go through the winter. And then hopefully if all goes well, it wakes up in the spring. It doesn't even know it was moved.
All right.
Oh, I like that idea. That's great.
That's a theory with a good chunk of moving plants that have been in the ground for a while.
Jody,
yeah,
thanks
well,
a lot.
That's really great. Well, thank you. And my other question is about my tomato plants. I start a bunch of plants every year. I've had a garden for many, many years. And
all right.
I started all my tomatoes, and they all look great. And I moved them into the garden. And in the last 2 weeks, I have so many plants. I experiment every year. Sometimes I put some in early and I take a chance and they don't work. I replace them.
Sure.
The plants I put in about 10 days ago have something that I can't identify on the leaves. And it's as if tiny little specks on some of the leaves have dried up and left sort of a coppery, almost like you can sort of see through the plant fibers, the leaf fibers, and then the rest of the leaf is okay. And they're little tiny spots, like pinhead size.
Yep, and they're brown, light brown, and almost see-through partially?
Yes, yes.
Yep. My guess, and I'm pretty sure that this is accurate here, is that it was an insect that did a little bit of feeding early on, and it may have been feeding when you may have been on there at the nursery when you bought them. It may have happened right afterwards, but it basically it made a little hole and it ate a little bit. They're little tiny, you know, little tiny piercing mouth part, and then it went away. It didn't stay on your plant. And then what happened was is that those little feeding spots where they were, you know, taking a little bit of food has now literally died. But it's isolated to that little feeding zone, and now you're left with these little tiny, almost see-through spots.
Will the tomato be okay?
Yeah, the plant looks healthy, I would assume, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of them look a little kind of wilty, but it's hard to say. We've been having rather extreme weather around here, you know, like snowy one day, 90 degrees the next.
Yep. I mean, if you wanted to take a picture of the leaf and send, you know, again, email it to me, I could, you know, verify that that's what it is. But it does sound like that. And the wilting, I would tend to think, is probably not related to the little brown micro spots. And we're talking about like almost like a pencil point size, right?
Right, right, yep. Exactly. But some of them are all together, so it makes a big area.
Yeah, because they're all individual little holes.
Yeah, okay. All right. Yep. And then the rest of the plant will be healthy as it grows?
Yeah, in fact, the new leaves that are coming out should not have that on it.
That is correct.
Yep. All right. That sounds like we got it.
All right, Jody, we got to move it along.
Not a
here.
Problem, though.
Let's go to Bob and Latham. Bob, let's get a call in here before the break. Bob, you're on.
Hey, guys. Hey. I'm interested in some of the new elm trees that are becoming available that are a little more resistant to Dutch elm and whatnot.
Yep.
I was wondering how available are those and where can I find them?
Well, it's funny you should ask. We are also at the Arboretum interested in those elms, and we plant them. We have them at our plant sales in the spring and fall and things like that. But we had a number of varieties of resistant variety elm trees at our plant sale, and we actually have a few leftovers. So if that was something that you could migrate your way out to the Landis Arboretum, I would say just give me a shout before you come down. I'll make sure I'm there and I can point you in the right direction. But we have some at the Arboretum for sale.
Okay.
A few different varieties. I can give you the write-up of what they are, and they're priced relatively inexpensively.
So what is the number one? What is the website of the Arboretum?
The website for the Landis Arboretum is www.landisarboretum.org. My email is fred@landisarboretum.org. I get my emails on my phone, so...
Yeah, during the show, I notice. And,
tweeting, texting, not while driving, Ray.
Right. And in 15 seconds before the break, why and how did these become resistant?
First off, the American elm was... and almost every city has got an elm street for a reason.
Yeah.
Because elms were probably the best... urban tree ever. They were called Elm Street because literally the entire street would be monocultured plant with elms. The elms would get great graceful forms, vase-like shapes.
Yeah.
Their canopies would actually reach over the road. They would form these tunnels of vegetative growth, and you couldn't get much more picturesque than a grove of elm trees, back in the day along a street. But Dutch elm disease, which is unfortunately a fungal problem that was brought over, is of Asian Orient origin, and came over, I believe, on packing crates.
Yeah.
And it's spread by a bark beetle that bores into the elms. But the bark beetles by themselves don't really cause any harm to the elm. But unfortunately, they're just a vector. They carry the disease. And once they bore into the vascular tissue or into the bark, disease is spread rapidly. And what it does is it blocks up vascular tissue. So if you want to think about trees... vascular tissue, which is basically a xylem, cambium, phloem. Think of them as veins and arteries. Our hearting, it literally plugs up those transport vessels.
All right, we'll take the other side of this, and that's how they developed resistant trees coming up after the break. The number to call, a couple of open lines, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. More with Fred Breglia, gardening, coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Foresight Land Services, Pittsfield, Massachusetts. For 45 years, offering civil engineering, land surveying, land planning, and environmental permitting to private and municipal clients in the Berkshires and Eastern New York. ForesightLand.com. Weewaka, Lake George, New York. An enrichment and revitalization historic lakefront retreat created by and for women since 1903. WIAWAKA.org for events. Unison Arts Center, New Paltz. Presenting a night of musical comedy, sight gags, and verbal quips with the clown troupe, The Maestrosities, Saturday, June 1st at 8 p.m., unisonarts.org. Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more, where eyewear is an art, Facebook or visionexceleyecare.com. And Snow Farm Williamsburg, a New England craft program offering creative arts workshops taught by master craftspeople for adults and teens, beginners and up, snowfarm.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Fred Breglia is our solo guest today. Greg Ward could not be with us. It's our gardening show, and we were talking about Dutch elm disease and a resistant strain, or more than one resistant strain, now coming into vogue. And so what's the science and what's the history of these resistant strains?
Well, ever since the Dutch elm disease became a major problem, and this sort of happened, I believe, back in it's before my time, but it's back in the 60s when the elms started to really die. And by the time, you know, I was born in 73, so by the time, you know, I was a little kid, I don't recall ever seeing any elms on Elm Street in Cobuskill, you know, which is where I grew up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe there was one. But there was always a few isolated ones around. In fact, there was a huge one over at the Cobuskill Library when I was a kid. And, in fact, it was there all the way through until probably about maybe 10 years ago when it eventually got caught the Dutch elm disease. So the plant breeders, hybridizers, arborists, they've been looking for a resistant variety for years. And now, you know, in 2013, there are a lot of really solid replacements for the American elm that are, you know, literally they're resistant variety cultivars.
So it's just been crossbreeding all this time?
Crossbreeding and you know, trial and errors, because just because it's resistant and it crossbreeds and you don't get Dutch elm disease doesn't mean it's going to look like an American elm. And now it takes years to find out what that tree actually looks like. And now some of these varieties have been around long enough that they can start to show you the mature characteristics. And some of them are looking really like, you know, classic American elm.
Well, that's great news.
And in most cases, they're, you know, predominantly almost all American elm, just a few little, you know, few little manipulations. But
beautiful. Great. That's great news.
If anyone really wants in-depth information, I have a lot of contacts in the elm societies and could easily, you know, put you in contact with the people that are doing the hybridizing and breeding. So
that'd be great.
If anyone's interested, just email me and I can send you those links.
All right, Fred, our producer Patrick Donges is here with more from the social media.
Hi, two questions, both via Facebook. Familia on Facebook asks, is that root pruning method you described for a tree peony the same method you'd use to move a couple of three-year-old apple trees that were healed in but never planted in their permanent spots?
So this is the vertical with the spade putting down, just over those micro roots or whatever.
Yeah,
you're
basically outlining you're going to dig a plant's root ball up. You're going to dig it up. And you kind of get an idea, you know, you want to try to put the biggest root ball you can handle on a plant. So if you're going to move it, you know, don't go for the small one. Go for the biggest one that you feel comfortable with. And once you'd establish what you feel comfortable with, then you get a spade, you go around it, you're cutting the roots, you're pulling it back out, and you're tracing it and not severing all the roots, but the plant's staying in the ground. You're not lifting it up and it doesn't go into shock. It can handle that. And it puts a lot more denser roots all closer to the stem. So yes, the answer to that question is that would be definitely what I would do if you were trying to move an apple tree. But I would, again, wouldn't try to move that unless it was absolutely essential to move it now. I would wait till that tree was dormant.
Okay, and when would that be?
That would be fall after the leaf drop or spring prior to the leaf's emergence.
Okay.
But after the soil's workable.
Gotcha.
Certain species will favor the spring and certain species will favor the fall. The majority of species can handle both times.
Okay. All right, I got one more. Gary on Facebook asks, I have three maples that are at least 53 years old in my yard. They're all dying. They were beautiful trees. See lots of small holes in all of them. What's killing my trees?
Well, you know, the fact, and I'd like to know what kind of maple, you know, it is. Okay. That would be nice to know. But the holes, I'm going to probably say, are probably, if they're in the trunk, are probably not related directly to the problem with the trees.
Okay.
My guess is that there's probably something going on environmentally with the roots. They could be, there could be girdling roots. They could be all planted too deep. We talked a little bit before about the need to make sure you plant the tree at the proper depth, making sure that the root flare is at ground level or slightly above. And all the years I've been doing arboricultural work, which now is really starting to add up, making me sound like an old timer.
Yeah.
I've never seen a plant or tree die from being planted too deep. Or I should take that back, from being planted too high. But I've seen countless plants die slowly over time.
But these trees are 53 years old.
That's right. And to give you an example of that, I years ago did a site visit for someone that had two maple trees, both planted at the same exact time, both of them in the 50-year range, 60-year-old range. One of them, perfectly healthy, beautiful tree, textbook. Mm. The other one, great structure, almost dead with its leaves. One of them, perfect root flare. The other one, the opposite of a root flare. Trunk goes straight into the ground, and then on top of that, you'll even see a mound of soil kind of pushed up around it. And what that is that root, as the trunk gets bigger, it's pushing soil, and literally as it pushes soil, the soil rises and creates an even bigger problem. And but a lot of times, it's like a bad problem with your back. When you're 5 years old, you're running around, you're playing ball with all the kids. In high school, you're still doing all right. When you're 40 years old,
you're
not doing too good anymore.
Well, that's trees depressing.
And plants and people are really similar in a lot of ways. So
all right.
My guess is something to do with the planting or girdling roots or if they had any construction work that perhaps rolled over the surface of the soil, that would also have a problem.
Okay, great. Patrick Donges.
Thanks for reading, Fred.
Nice you got work. It, Patrick. Let's go to the Thank phones you. Once again. Nina and Huzik, you're on.
Hey, how are you? Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Okay, I have a breed of hydrangea called Endless Summer, and I bought them when they were safe in pots, and so they grew beautifully, and then they were putting out very nice fat blossoms. About 3 years into, I've had them now for six. For the last 3 years, no matter what I do, I can't get them to rebloom. And I called the nursery where I bought them, and they said, use phosphorus. I used phosphorus. Then I added compost around the drip line, and I like them blue, so I put acidifier, you know, into the ground, you know, put in, like, little holes and acidifier at the drip line. That's for the color. And I am getting absolutely nowhere. I have giant, endlessly blooming green bushes, no blossoms. Can you help me?
Yes, I can. Almost guaranteed here, I would say, is that what's going on is a lot of these endless summer varieties now, depending on where they were grown, tend to be a little bit marginal for their flower buds through the winter. So the hardiness of the flower bud is not as much as the leaf hardiness. The leaf hardiness, no problem, goes through the winter, not a single dead leaf, tons of great foliage.
Yeah.
But the flower buds sometimes get burned back in the wintertime, and they are unable to actually function once the spring hits. So my guess is the fact that you have really healthy plants with no flowers is probably almost guaranteed winter injury on the flower buds only. And one way to perhaps prevent that from happening to a degree is to use burlap and make little pens around them for the winter months, and because that's when the issue is occurring. You want to try to shelter them, give them a little extra protection from winter winds and cold temperatures. So one of the ways I've told people to do this in the past is you use little sticks and you make a little fence out of burlap. Ideally, burlap works really well because it keeps a lot of the winter winds back, but it still lets the plant be able to get, you know, air in there and breathe and stuff, but it does shelter it, and that might just be the ticket, preventing some of that winter injury in the flower buds. I'd be willing to bet.
Okay.
On
it. Nina, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Laurel in, or is it Laurel in Stone Ridge? You're on.
Hi, it's Laurel.
Hi, Laurel.
Mountain Laurel.
You're on.
I have two American ornamental American cranberries that flank the entry to my shade garden, and they've been in place for about 5 years. And every year the one gets, the leaves become lacy as if somebody's eating them. Nothing on the other plant and nothing on any other plant or tree surrounding. So I'm just wondering, you know, what that might be.
And that hasn't happened this year yet, has it?
It actually has yes.
And they become lacy as in you see the veins of the leaf, but the foliage, the actual foliage is being removed, or more like the leaf is still intact, everything, but it looks more transparent, or
no? It's the veins remain, and the the body of the leaf is missing.
All right,
it's like a leaf pattern.
Okay, well, have you seen insects on them?
I have not seen any insects, and again, it affects only one of the two trees that are probably 5 feet apart.
Interesting, but you know that actually is not as surprising as it sounds, only because if one was insects, first off, I would say that the problem is an insect. Japanese beetle is classic for that kind of damage, but there are other insects that also create that. They eat the foliage and they leave the veins intact. It kind of skeletonizes the leaf. And there are a number of skeletonizing insects out there. They call them skeletonizing because of the effect that the leaf looks like. So my guess is guaranteed some kind of leaf foliar eater, leaf skeletonizer. Nothing else I could think of that would ever cause skeletonized leaves. Now, the fact that it's only on one, do you see any skeletonized leaves on the other one at all, or zero?
Sometimes, and this has happened multiple years in a row, and sometimes I see it on the other one, but it's just a fraction, maybe not even 5% of the leaves, whereas the one that's affected is probably 80% of the leaves.
So it's kind of odd how that occurs, but what insects and diseases do is it's kind of like, again, I'm relating plants to people here. I guess that's the theme of today's show. But basically, when you have a stressed out plant, something that's a little bit more stressed out than the other one, the insects actually, the plant will give off pheromones, and the insects can literally sense which one is a little hardier, and they'll go for the weaker of the two.
Why? Now, wouldn't the hardier one be tastier?
You certainly would think so, but I think that a lot of times trees have natural defenses. So they can actually, like, for example, an apple borer getting laid into an egg getting laid into a healthy apple stem, when those little borers hatch, a good healthy apple will actually produce enough sap flow to drown them and suffocate them.
Oh, amazing.
So you go to the one that's weak. So that's my guess. It's almost it's guaranteed, I would say, probably an insect. Leaf skeletonizer of some sort. Japanese beetle is really famous for that. But like I said, there's a number of other insects that can cause that kind of symptom. And the fact that one is getting it over the other is probably that one is probably a little bit more stressed. Do they both look about the same, or does the one that get it look a little bit weaker?
I'd say they look approximately the same. And then I guess my last question then would be, what is the treatment
Well, the first thing I would do is, we want to find the culprit. So you really want to try to find that insect, if possible. And a lot of times, keep in mind that plant insects that do eat, other than Japanese beetles, the majority of the insects that feed on and cause problems with plants are very small. They're not large insects. The large ones are almost always beneficial or neutral. And about 90% of all the insects or more are actually beneficial or neutral to plants. So it's a very small percentage.
Is there a good time of day to look for them?
Well, that's what I was going to say. Try different times of day. Try early morning. Try middle of the day if you can. Try it, when you get home from work. Try evening. Try to see if we can capture an insect on that leaf. And then if you do, let me know what that is. You can text me a picture of it or send me a picture of it via email. Call me at the Arboretum. Bring me a leaf. Bring me a sample. Bring the insect over in a vial, not loose, please. And just in case it's something really wild.
Or call us next time.
Yeah,
other option.
But I hate to prescribe something without actually seeing it. But so once we knew what it was, we could easily treat for it. But that's not going to be a real bad thing and not a hard thing to do with that kind of symptom.
Let's go to Diane and Kaksaki. Diane, you're on.
Hi. I've had really good luck with hostas. They grow like crazy. You can't kill them. But this year when I went to clean up the dead vegetation around, and when I pulled up on them, they just came right up off the soil. They like have no roots. They're sitting on the soil.
Yep. That's probably almost guaranteed. My guess is a vole, V-O-L-E. Not to blame the moles.
No.
Moles and voles are different. And the voles are notoriously ruthless when it comes to a lot of perennial roots. They'll eat. They're plant eaters. They don't just eat the roots of plants. They also come around in the wintertime and they'll girdle apple trees and cherry trees and trees that have really sweet bark and soft bark. So good measure for any of the new trees that are planted, especially if they're apple, plum, cherry, pear, peach, any of those, is preventatively you wrap them in the fall, take it off in the spring. We do that with everything that's new at the Arboretum that we plant, and it keeps a lot of them alive. But voles are can be really destructive, and moles.
How do you get rid of them without spraying horrible pesticides and chemicals?
If you go online, there's a whole arsenal of build a better vole trap.
Yeah.
Like the old game Mousetrap.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different ideas for that. If you could find the vole holes, there's been a lot of different methods, everything from hot peppers, capsicum types of products that you can put in there.
Yeah.
I've heard cat litter also works.
I'll be darned.
But nothing probably better than a good old mouser.
Kitty cat.
Cat. Work really well. You can certainly set traps too for them and try to get them out that way. But it's almost guaranteed that if you have them, you pull them right out, roots healthy every year. You know what you're doing with the hosta. Voles came in and got you.
Okay.
Yep.
I'll be darned. Yep. All right, Diane. Hey, I'm sorry about the bad news, but good luck with the voles.
That's okay, as long as it's not some kind of disease or something.
Nope, sounds classic. My guess is that a lot of your other ones are probably looking okay, right? So
these don't look bad. They just don't seem to have any roots.
Well, that's interesting.
But they're green?
Yeah.
Oh, they haven't wilted yet?
No.
Well, hosta leaves tend to take a little while to wilt. My guess is that they will, and they must have just been eaten then.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
Yeah, Mike, it sounds like very recent activity, because otherwise they, you know, no roots means it's not going to last long.
No, or maybe they're fake. Maybe they're plastic. I mean,
well, that would also give you a good looking hosta with no root.
Well, there you go. Well, hey, listen, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks a lot.
We are out of time. And, Fred, you were solo today, but you did a darn good job.
Well, you know, I try to focus on trees when we have multiple guests here because that's one of my favorite types of plants. But been in the horticultural industry for literally since I was 13, and if you count when I was helping mom and dad with tomatoes and flower gardens, that was what, you know, age 3,
yeah.
Maybe 2. It's all I've ever done. I've got no other work experience except for horticultural industry.
Well, so nice to have you here. We'll have you back again. Maybe we'll have the whole gang, or maybe not. We'll find out how things roll. Maybe Greg will show up. Support comes from Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, and resume and cover letter writing. Careers in Transition, LLC.com. Capcom Federal Credit Union offering home mortgages, auto loans, checking, financial planning, and more. CapcomFCU.org. Berkshire Botanical Garden, Stockbridge, Massachusetts, featuring their exhibit, Rare Earth Garden Pots, a sculpture by potter Mark Hewitt. Garden shop is open and garden group tours are available. BerkshireBotanical.org. And Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarry and fabrication used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking. Rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, AshfieldStone.com. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who did the controls. Thanks to Callie Winkeller for answering the telephones today. Our producer is Patrick Donges. Thanks to Fred Breglia. The news is next.